Morning, may it please the court. My name is Thomas Seaman. I'm with the law firm of Seaman and Chambers. My registration number is 4172. We are here representing the defendant appellant, American National Property and Casualty Company. We've referred to them throughout our briefs in this case as ANPAC, which is simply an acronym for that rather lengthy name of our client insurance company. This matter is an important one. This case is an important one because it involves insurance fraud, and it involves the role of our courts in terms of combating insurance fraud in Colorado. The declaration section of the statute on insurance fraud indicates that the Division of Insurance has found that insurance fraud is expensive in Colorado. It's expensive to all of us, and the legislature has identified roles that need to be played by not only the insurance industry itself, but the regulatory agency, which is the Division of Insurance, and ultimately the state government, which includes the courts. I think less common than involvement by the Division of Insurance or the legislature or the industry itself is involvement by the courts, but this case represents one opportunity and an example of the court becoming involved in terms of combating insurance fraud. This is a case involving insurance fraud that was committed by the plaintiff when he forged an endorsement of a body shop on a check that was issued by ANPAC for payment of the auto repairs to his vehicle, which was damaged in an accident. And then he converted those funds to his own use by depositing those funds in his own checking account. The jury in this case was instructed by the court on the issue of insurance fraud, and they got instructions 37 and 38, which define the elements of insurance fraud and also the issue of whether the defense of insurance fraud had been waived in this case or whether there had been waiver by the insurance company. And the jury instructions have not been challenged by the plaintiff in this case. So the jury found that there was insurance fraud, and they awarded ANPAC the roughly $4,900 amount that it had to pay twice. The reason that had to be paid twice is they had to issue a second draft to the lien holder when the proceeds from the first draft were converted by the plaintiff.
Counsel, when I read the trial court's order, I noticed that it talked about ANPAC not seeking a remedy of denial of insurance. Can you address that?
I think ANPAC did seek a remedy of denial of insurance by virtue of its counterclaim that was filed when the case was filed in litigation by its insured. When the suit was filed by the plaintiff in this case against ANPAC, the claims that were filed were claims for insurance benefits, specifically no fault or PIP benefits under the policy, and there was a claim for initially for I think wage loss benefits and then eventually for medical expenses, and I might have those reversed. I'm not sure which came first because the claims were actually presented separately. But ANPAC in its answer included a counterclaim. The essence of the counterclaim was seeking a declaratory judgment that because of the insurance fraud, the court should exercise its authority under the declaratory judgment statute to declare that there was no coverage or that the coverage would be voided as a result of the Fraudulent Insurance Act. And the basis for the claim or the counterclaim for insurance fraud and seeking the relief of the court is the Fraudulent Insurance Act that's been adopted by the legislature in Colorado. Our position is that that piece of legislation gives the court the authority and the jurisdiction to avoid insurance coverage when there's proof, as there was in this case, of insurance fraud.
So that I'm understanding then, your position is that was an issue that would be resolved by the trial court as part of a declaratory judgment and not an issue that would be appropriate for the jury to consider.
Exactly, Your Honor. And the court recognized that and on a couple of occasions preceding the actual jury verdict. When it ruled against the plaintiff and denied a motion for summary judgment, which was seeking dismissal of the declaratory judgment counterclaim, and the court denied that, indicating that it was a jury's role or function to find whether or not there was insurance fraud. And then based on that finding, the court either could or could not, depending on what the court decided, enter a declaratory judgment, but the factual finding had to be made by the jury, and that was the jury's role or function in this case with regard to the insurance fraud. Second time that the court addressed that was during trial when the plaintiff filed a motion for directed verdict, again asking the court to dismiss the declaratory judgment counterclaim, and once again the court indicated there was a fact issue that was unresolved and that the jury needed to resolve that based upon instructions which we would argue the court properly gave to the jury as to whether there was or was not insurance fraud.
Excuse me, Mr. Seaman, what is the language in the statute that provides for voiding the benefits in the event of a finding of insurance fraud?
No, we think it's the, I will concede that you have to, I think, read the statute broadly in order to find that language, but under 10.1.127, we think it's the language in subsection paragraph 7A, and this is in 10.1.127, that requires required insurance companies to include a written statement provided to their insureds that it's unlawful to knowingly provide false, incomplete, or misleading facts or information to an insurance company for the purpose of defrauding or attempting to defraud the company. Penalties may include imprisonment, fines, denial of insurance, and civil damages. We think that language, and reading the statute broadly and as a whole, taking into account all of the language, and including in that the General Assembly's statement of purpose or the declaration portion of the statute, which says that the General Assembly finds and declares that the state of Colorado must aggressively confront the problem of insurance fraud by facilitating detection of it, reducing its occurrence through stricter enforcement. But the reading statute as a whole, that once insurance fraud is found, one of the remedies that can be ordered, and it can only be ordered with the assistance of the court in a declaratory judgment sense, one of the remedies is denial of insurance or the coverage.
So you're saying by referring to a penalty, then that authorizes the court in a declaratory judgment to deny coverage?
Reading the statute in the whole, that that's the intent of the legislation, and that the court is given that authority. And that's what Judge Rafferty found when he entered his declaratory judgment as part of the amended and supplemental judgment order in this case.
Was there a reason that he entered it only as to the wage benefits as opposed to the health benefits? Or maybe I've got that reversed.
So. No, I think you have it. He entered the declaratory judgment only as to the wage loss claim and allowed the award of benefits for medical expenses to stand. We think that was incorrect. We think that if the court finds that the statute or that there was insurance fraud and that the consequence of that insurance fraud is voiding coverage, and all of the benefits sought under that same coverage, which would include not only wage loss but also medical expenses, should have been voided as well. So we don't think the court, we think the court reached a proper decision with regard to declaring the coverage was void. We just don't think it, that the court took it far enough, and we think it was error to carve out an exception and say this part of your coverage is not void and this part of it is void. It just doesn't make any logical sense that that was performed in that fashion.
Mr. Seaman, as I understand it, there was no anti-fraud provision in Mr. O'Hanlon's policy. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. And so the basis for the argument was being made by trial counsel, and I was not trial counsel in the case, but the trial counsel argued to the court, and the court accepted this argument, is that the enactment of this statute allowed an insurance company to have the remedies that would be available to it if there was an anti-fraud clause or provision in the policy.
Well, assuming that a trial court judge does have discretion then to deny insurance coverage if there is a finding of fraud, what factors do you think would guide the exercise of that discretion by the trial court in a situation like this where the fraud related to the payment for damage to the car, but the remedy that you're seeking relates to payment of other benefits for medical benefits and wages?
I think, you know, the same case law that applies to enforcement of insurance fraud clauses and policies, which allows, once there's a finding of fraud on the part of an insured, that remedy that is allowed if you have an insurance fraud clause is to void the coverage entirely, entire policy.
Isn't there a difference? I'm sorry.
Exists in the trial court to apply that same ruling and void the policy or the coverage entirely.
But isn't there a difference, though, between a policy provision that says if you commit fraud, you don't get any coverage whatsoever on the one hand, and a statute that says to a district court, one of the possible remedies for fraud is to deny coverage?
Well, I think in both instances, it's the remedy that is sought is the same. The way the statute reads is denial of insurance, and it doesn't specify that the only remedy or the only consequence to an insured committing insurance fraud is to avoid only that coverage under which the fraud was committed, in this case the property damage coverage, and allow that insurer who defrauded the insurance company to reap the benefits of the other coverages.
I understand that. That's why I was asking more specifically if the trial court judge does have discretion with regard to the remedy. Is it unfettered discretion, or how would the trial court exercise its discretion and say, well, you can't get the coverage back for the property damage, but I'm also not going to let you cover for wage loss or medical benefits?
I think the trial court's discretion is broad, and if there's a finding of fraud, as there is here, by a jury, I think the court can then step in and say that the remedy for that, or consequence, if you will, is the denial of insurance to this individual who committed fraud.
Would the court have discretion to only deny the coverages to the wage and not to the medical? For example, only do a limited denial of coverage as one of the penalties?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because the coverage, again, is the same, and it's a no-fault or PIP coverage. It might be different if the court said, well, I'm going to only, for example, deny the property damage coverage, but we're going to allow the no-fault or PIP coverage to stand. The no-fault or PIP coverage provides for wage loss and provides for medical expenses, and it makes no sense, and it's inconsistent for the court to find that there's a denial of coverage for wage loss but not for the medical expense because it's the same coverage. I've got about 3 minutes left, and I'd like to reserve that for rebuttal with one exception, and that is the attorney's fees issue in this case, we think, which is a issue briefed by the parties, is pretty, I think, pretty cut and dry. The attorney's fees, if the court finds that some benefits were owed, and we don't think that they were, we don't think attorney's fees are recoverable because of the language in the no-fault statute that required a timely service of the notice to insure of amount claim. The only provision for attorney's fees is statutory. It's in derogation of common law. Statute has to be interpreted and applied strictly construed, and we don't think that there was compliance with that statute. So regardless of the finding with regard to whether there are any benefits entitled, we don't think attorney's fees should be awarded, nor should there be an award of treble damages when we have this significant issue of fact as to whether there's insurance fraud that would void coverage entirely.
On the issue of treble damages, did that go to the willful and wanton?
It did, Your Honor.
Did you specify that in the jury instructions? Did you
instruct it on willful and wanton, and they found willful and wanton, but we don't think the jury should have even been allowed to consider willful and wanton because of the significant fact issue as to whether or not there was insurance fraud. And the case law indicates that in order for the jury to find willful and wanton denial of benefits, there has to be a denial without any reasonable basis whatsoever. Here, the existence of insurance fraud, we think, created at least a reasonable basis that you know, should have allowed the jury not to consider.
Well, I thought your concern was that they weren't provided with a definition of willful and wanton.
I don't think that they were provided with a definition of willful and wanton.
And so why isn't that waived unless you offered it and the trial court rejected it?
I think that the decision whether to instruct the jury at all on willful and wanton is what we're challenging here. Granted, there was not an objection specifically or even a tendered instruction, but I think there was an objection made during trial as to the allowing the jury to even consider that claim, and our position is the court should not have allowed it to be considered.
Thank you, Mr. Seaman. You're down to like 25 seconds for your...
Sorry.
So.
Good morning. If it pleases the court, my name is Bruce Rohde. I represent Ken O'Hanlon.
Mr. Rohde, before you get started, just as in the first oral argument, I'd like to ask if you intend to divide your time with your other co-counsel, and if so, how?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Very well. You may proceed.
I'd like to address two declaratory judgments that the trial court entered, the one regarding the medical benefit claim and the second regarding the wage claim, and then briefly address the treble damages issue and then the set-off issue and then, time permitting, the attorney's fees award. I will leave the scope of the jurisdiction issue for the briefs. We believing that the court knows what it intended to do with on remand, and whether the trial court exceeded the scope of the remand when it entered it. It's amended in supplemental order and judgment 2 years after the fact without the benefit of a transcript. If it had not entered at least the declaratory judgments in that amended and supplemental order and judgment 2 years after the fact, we wouldn't be here arguing about those declaratory judgments. So the medical benefit claim, we believe first that the court's holding that it should not reach the issue of whether it should enter a declaratory judgment regarding the jury's award of medical benefits, because AMPAC did not seek a declaratory judgment in the second case regarding medical benefits. That was a correct decision. Remember, the court noted that in the second case regarding medical benefits, AMPAC only raised the so-called insurance fraud, the issues regarding the check, as an affirmative defense. So the trial court's holding that the judgment in favor of O'Hanlon for unpaid medical benefits is consistent with the jury's verdict, finding a breach of contract and waiver of any issues regarding the check as a defense to its obligation to pay benefits, is supported by the law. The court is aware waiver can be applied. One can and often does waive one's right of rescission and elect instead to affirm the contract and seek to recover damages. That's precisely what AMPAC did here.
Mr. Rohde, what is your response to Mr. Seaman's argument that under the anti-fraud statute, Mr. O'Hanlon shouldn't have gotten anything?
That, first of all, you've got to raise the declaratory judgment claim seeking that remedy in the case if that's the kind of relief you want. And as the court recognized, they didn't do that. AMPAC did not do that. Second, as a factual matter, you've got to, the insurance company has to elect not to waive that defense. Let me quote you, Your Honor, from page 200 of the CD. I ask Ms. Samsell, the claims adjuster, to read from the claims log. She recites from her claims log, "We should file a countersuit against the insured for breach of contract due to misrepresentation and fraud, since the insured forged the shop's name on the collision check. I advised how I would let him know how we want to proceed on that issue on the collision check." They elected to treat this as a debt, not to assert any alleged insurance fraud as a defense to coverage.
So you agree that there was authority, excuse me, you agree that there was authority then to void it, but that they procedurally waived it?
No, I also claim, you know, not only did they not plead it, and not only did they waive any right to recover it, and why? Because their own attorney told them that because they didn't have a anti-fraud provision in their policy, they had no recourse. And I agree on that one point with trial counsel Hipschweiler. We find no authority in the statute for the propositions that counsel makes, that you can void coverage completely and that the judge has unfettered discretion in that regard. And then I heard As a matter of fact, in the exercise of that unfettered position or discretion, it's an all-or-nothing proposition. If there's any kind of insurance fraud at all, it appears that ANPAC's position is that there can be no coverage at all. And we do not believe that that's the law in Colorado.
What do you think the purpose of that statutory language is then, referring to the penalties for the insurance fraud?
Well, I think that it gave the court the authority to do exactly what happened here before the amended and supplemental judgment was entered, and that is permit an insurance company to seek from the fact finder appropriate remedial relief under the circumstances. And here, that's precisely what the jury did. It awarded ANPAC all the damages it found that it suffered, the $4,900, and nothing more. Even though in a stipulated instruction, the jury was told down to the penny what ANPAC paid in wage and medical benefits. So that if the jury had wanted to, they could have awarded ANPAC, allowed it to recoup, if you will, all the benefits that it had paid, or a portion of the benefits it had paid, either wages or medical benefits, but it did not do that. So not only do we have what I just mentioned, the insurance company's own counsel telling the claims adjuster that inasmuch as we don't have an anti-fraud provision in the policy, we don't have any recourse for the check issues. And the trial and the ANPAC's attorney advising ANPAC that at most it might be able to set off, which is still treating it as a debt, the amount of the check from the wage benefits, but that it's no excuse for not paying the medical benefits. We got ANPAC doing absolutely nothing for a period of years, except having its attorney, trial counsel Hipschweiler, meet with Mr. O'Hanlon and try to set up a payment plan. We have our expert in insurance practices, Mr. Conway, testified based on that and other evidence. In his opinion, ANPAC elected to waive any check issues, alleged insurance fraud, and treat the matter as a debt. And then remember, we've got ANPAC paying both medical benefits and wage benefits, notwithstanding the issues regarding the check. And Ms. Samsell, claim adjuster Samsell's testimony that, oh, by the way, we would have paid for the surgery had we got clearance from Sloan's Lake, and we would have paid for even the England surgery if it had passed muster with peer review. So we have, I submit, not only sufficient evidence, not only substantial evidence, but overwhelming evidence supporting the waiver. So since this court, as should the trial court, resolve verdicts consistent whenever possible, and since declaratory judgments, like other equitable relief, should be consistent with the factual findings of the jury and the verdicts of the jury, that's the Marquardt decision, the declaratory judgment affirming essentially the award of medical benefits should stand. But how does that possibly square, I asked the court, with the declaratory judgment voiding coverage for wage benefits? I submit it does not. I suppose one could ruminate and conceptualize and come up with a factual circumstance in which the jury could find that ANPAC, on the one hand, waived any issues regarding the check, any alleged insurance fraud as it pertains to medical benefits, but did not, on the other hand, did not waive any check issues or alleged insurance fraud with respect to wage benefits. But there's no facts in the record to support that here. I've tried to rather copiously cite the record regarding the evidence of waiver, and I think it was a blanket waiver on ANPAC's part what are we going to do with these check issues? We're going to seek to recover. We're going to treat it as a debt and a claim for damages and seek to recover damages. 2 years later, sure, by way of counterclaim in the first case regarding wage benefits, they raised the declaratory judgment claim, but they can't unring the bell. The alleged insurance fraud had been waived. On the treble damages, I submit willful and wanton is decidedly an issue of fact. Just because you file a declaratory judgment claim later does not immunize you from your independent duty of bad faith. That's the American Family v. Bowser decision, which interestingly was tried by Attorney Hipschweiler, where this court specifically found that the opportunity to file a declaratory judgment action is independent of the duty of good faith. There was no declaratory judgment claim in the second case regarding medical benefits anyway. There was no need for willful and wanton instruction. There is no stock instruction indicating that the crafters of the jury instructions at least believes that the term is common and plain enough for people to know and understand. And of course, they didn't tender an instruction or raise any contemporaneous objection at trial to the failure of the court to give a willful one instruction. So under Rule 51 and Shear v. Cromwell, I think that ends the matter. Regarding set-off, the court puzzles me as I stand here today. Why the court set off the $4,900 from the medical benefits is a mystery to me. There was no claim for damages on ANPAC's part in the second case, the medical benefits case, at all. And importantly, the set-off had the effect of trebling the $4,900 that the jury awarded them for fraud. Because if you offset the $4,900 from the $35,000 or so that we were awarded for the medical benefits before you treble, it gives triple effect.
Mr. Rohde, are you aware of any case law that supports your position that what the trial court did in the set-off is improper?
The statute itself, Your Honor. We've just heard that it should be followed to the letter. That works both ways. And the statute itself says an amount which is three times the amount of the unpaid benefit. Statute doesn't say three times the amount of the unpaid benefit less what the insured might owe the insurance company at the time, like maybe an overdue premium. It says three times the amount of the unpaid benefit, and in order to give effect to the punitive and deterrent effect of the statute, it shouldn't be diluted. It should be three times the amount of the unpaid benefit. Attorney's fees. Right after trial, in the minute orders that the court entered, the court finds excusable neglect because I, trial counsel, thought that Rule 121 applied. Court later concludes, well, I don't know if that's excusable neglect because while the rule may govern the procedure for the award of attorney's fees, the statute governs the right to attorney's fees. That's a finding made, again, 24 months after the fact. But importantly, it's worth mentioning the Morgan County Department of Social Services v. GAC case. AMPAC lied in the weeds. Instead of bringing the statute front and center before trial and saying, look, Judge, Rohde doesn't think the statute applies. AMPAC does think the statute applies, and if it applies, you need to make a finding right now of whether there's excusable neglect. And then if there is excusable neglect, we're entitled to a continuance. Instead of doing that, as the trial court found, and I think the court reviews this finding regarding tactics, this finding by the trial court for an abuse of discretion, trial court found instead as a tactical matter, they decided, no, we'll just point out that we've got a problem with their request for attorney's fees and then try to get a second bite of the apple later, arguing that they didn't follow the statute. That's not permissible. It wasn't permissible in
Counsel, I know your time is running out, but I want to ask you a question about attorney's fees. The provision 10.4708.1.17a says in pertinent part, the notice shall also specify the amount of any claim for attorney's fees. That seems to be fairly clear and unambiguous. How do we get around that?
How do I get around it? It's a notice statute. I think the trial court was correct. I think there is no prejudice. The trial court found that. AMPAC hasn't even argued any prejudice as a result of its failure to have been given notice prior to the trial in this case of the precise amount of attorney's fees. The trial court correctly found that it had constructive notice that we were going to seek to recover fees. All it lacked was notice of the precise amount. Statute isn't this, the notice requirement of the statute isn't just for amount of fees, it's for the amount of claim and fees. It's designed for use in arbitration proceedings as well in trials. And under the circumstances where there's no prejudice to AMPAC here, and then I hasten back to Morgan County in light of the way their failure to mention it, they waived it or stopped from asserting it in the first place, or if they try to assert it in light of no prejudice, it doesn't bar the claim.
Thank you, Mr. Rohde. Mr. Seaman, although you have, if I remember correctly, oh, it's 25 seconds, we'll give you an additional couple of minutes since Mr. Rohde spent an additional few minutes responding to Judge Roman's question.
I'd like to address first that issue that was just addressed in terms of attorney's fees and what happened at the time of trial. I think to argue that AMPAC waived its defense under the statute to the attorney's fees claim by not pointing out to Mr. Rohde and his co-counsel that their role in all of this was to establish excusable neglect, if that's what they were claiming, is disingenuous. I think what happened at the time of trial is the trial counsel indicated there had not been a timely service of the notice to ensure amount claim, which is required under the statute. And at that point in time, I think the burden then shifts to the attorney who's failed to provide that timely notice to argue that there's excusable neglect if that's what their claim is. And if there is a claim of excusable neglect, then the sole remedy is to vacate the trial and to continue until after there is the timely notice. But they had notice that the statute was being cited as a defense to their claim, and they just basically either ignored it or misunderstood where they stood, the role that they had in the case.
Mr. Seaman, excuse me if I may interrupt. Well, what is your response to Mr. Rohde's point that even if the terms of the statute weren't followed or followed properly, that there was no prejudice to AMPAC and therefore not following the statute is excusable?
I don't think the legislature required a showing of prejudice. I think that, again, this is a statute providing for attorney's fees. It's in derogation of common law, and the statute couldn't be clearer. It says if no timely notice is served, no attorney's fees shall be awarded, and it's just that simple. I want to address the argument by counsel that because there was no fraud clause in this policy, that there's no remedy available for insurance fraud. The argument is equivalent to saying that if without a fraud clause, insureds can commit insurance fraud at will without any consequences at all. And I think that's one reason that the statute exists, is to establish consequences for insurance fraud, even in the absence of an insurance fraud clause in the policy. Counsel concedes in his argument that the statute gave the court authority to do exactly what it did here, which was to have the jury decide the issue of whether or not there was insurance fraud. But here the jury took that as far as it could. They were asked and they were given instructions 37 and 38 to decide whether there was insurance fraud. The court then said, basically said that the court would take it from there.
Excuse me, Mr. Seaman, your even extended time has expired now, so.
Thank you.
Thank you for your argument. Thank you again, Mr. Rohde, for your argument, counsel. We appreciate your arguments this morning, and the case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.